Broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain, BC, we are CJSF 90.1 FM, and we are diverse, independent, and yours.
You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. This is the last in a series that I've been doing looking at the long-term environmental impacts we've had on society since I began Earth Day in 1980. And at the last show, we were looking at GMOs, or genetically modified organisms, or in this case, genetically modified foods. Are they as dangerous as the alarmists say they are? So I was looking at the various environmental groups and what the claims they're making, and are they as extreme and serious as they claim? So last time we looked at GMO, genetically modified corn, and whether it affected monarch butterflies. And we mentioned that the monarch is not an endangered species, but half of its caterpillars hatched in the U.S. Corn Belt. And although the caterpillars do not have to get pretty far far away to avoid the genetically modified pollen, if you're a monarch butterfly, the odds are that you're going to be close to a cornfield. Time magazine asked itself whether this new threat to the monarch could happen in cornfields across the American Midwest. And Discovery magazine claimed incorrectly that the monarchs had been poisoned irreversibly. So here's an example of quite a respectable journal producing alarmist material that has actually proved false. However, the hysteria reached a point where a coalition of 60 environmental groups and organic farmers, with Greenpeace leading the way, prepared to sue the Environmental Protection Agency in the United States for failing to protect the monarch butterfly by approving GM corn. And this is after years and years and years of testing had failed to find any significant harm produced by the corn. And in Europe, the monarch story caused the European Commission to delay approval for GM corn. Yet, it is not really surprising monarchs died from the substance that is in genetically modified corn, namely BT. BT is a natural insecticide toxic to Lepidodrian insects. And yes, monarchs are Lepidodrian insects. And the original Cornell University report specifically stated that all of the mortality seems to be due to the effects of the BT toxin. Thus, the story is not about GM, or genetic modification, but about BT. Unfortunately, the study was not repeated with ordinary corn pollen dusted on milkweed and spiked with organic BT. But it is unlikely that this would not also have caused high mortality. As with many of the other experiments, the GM feature was the hook of the story, but unrelated to the main issue, which was that natural toxins, whether it's lictin or BT, are toxic. The question, of course, is whether a story about butterflies dying from the usage of organic BT sprays would have made headlines. No, they wouldn't. What makes the headlines is alleged allegations that butterflies are dying from synthetic BT incorporated into genetic modified corn. Moreover, as one of the caterpillar researchers pointed out, it is impossible to imagine that we can grow food and only affect target pests. Using pesticides would always have non-target effects. This is known as systemic unintended consequences. And indeed, the very plowing of a field, the most fundamental action that a farmer can take, has massive effects that were not originally intended. Nevertheless, it is of course important to look at the consequences of large-scale use of BT toxins. The EPA published in October 2000 its preliminary risks and benefits evaluation of BT genetically modified crops. Summing up on extensive field testing, they found that the actual level of BT encountered by caterpillars ranged from relatively low to very low, and there was very little time overlap between monarch breeding and pollen shedding. In conclusion, the EPA found there was a very low probability for adverse effects from BT corn on monarch butterflies, and specifically on monarch larvae, the caterpillars, and that there was no reason to have undue concern widespread risks to monarch butterflies at this time. And because of this conclusion, this is the reason why they approved genetically modified corn. However, this was certainly not enough for the coalition of 60 environmental groups that had allied themselves to Greenpeace to oppose all genetic modified food. In fact, in its conclusion, the EPA noted that since these GM crops need much less pesticide, they even predicted that the widespread cultivation of BT crops would have huge benefits for monarch butterfly survival because there'd be far less use of free air pesticides sprayed from aircraft and by machinery because the corn itself carried the gene to produce the insecticide within itself, thereby actually reducing the exposure of monarch butterfly larvae to pesticides. So in fact, this could actually be a blessing for monarch butterflies and not a curse. But of course, this was never discussed in the Discovery article or any other article written by people with an axe to grind. So we reach the point now where we can ask, genetically modified foods, is it a disaster or is it a blessing? Genetically modified foods have been claimed to be a potential disaster by numerous environmental groups, or something that we should outright love from the proponents like Monsanto. Why this huge gap in judgments? No doubt part of the reason is caused by the lack of information. In a number of surveys, Europeans were asked whether it was true or false that ordinary tomatoes do not contain genes while genetic modified tomatoes do. Half correctly said that this was false, but the other half thought it was true. These people actually believe that the good old food is gene-free, whereas the new genetically modified foods shoves foreign genes down their throat. The ignorance here is amazing. Moreover, more than 40% knew that the ingesting the genes from the genetically modified food would not modify their own genes. That means that 60% of people did not know this. And on other surveys show that Americans know relatively even less than this. No wonder with such widespread ignorance about basic genetics, there's such a widespread worry over genetically modified foods. Environmental groups are actually taking advantage of people's genetic ignorance and cashing in on it, of course, to get donations for their activities. And yes, as we have seen, the most exploited scare stories of toxic potatoes, allergenic beans, and dead monarchs were based on myths, not scientific fact. Nevertheless, there are also real problems to be considered. Our exposure to the myths showed us some of the problematic. We know by far the most important human allergens, but we do not know the consequences of using genes from non-food organisms. We should make allergicity tests for these, but since we do not know, what we are looking for. We can never be absolutely sure to find everything. There's also rightly concern for antibiotic resistance. Spliced genes have often conveniently been marked with genes coding for resistance to specific antibiotics. This has led to concerns that the resistance gene might be transferred to human pathogens in the gut, which would make them impervious to useful antibiotics. It is important to avoid such a situation. Equally, there is anxiety that genetically modified crops may spread their pesticide resistance to weeds. If this was possible, and it has not been proven to be such, such superweeds, just as superbugs in the hospital, would lessen the value of the pesticide and make pest control much harder. We know the problems of superweeds, from Johnson grass choking crops and fields, to kudzu blanketing trees, to Melaleuca trees invading the Everglades. These are concerns that should be addressed. Yet we also have to remember that while genetic modification could potentially risk incorporating new allergens, the technique also holds enormous promise at removing many of the most common allergens and thus of significantly reducing the troubles of present-day sufferers. While the early genetic modification technology potentially could cause selective antibiotic resistance, this risk is very small compared to normal pathways of antibiotic resistance, and new technologies are increasingly becoming available to prevent this. Finally, while pesticide-resistant weeds would be a nuisance, many have pointed out that it is unlikely that such resistance could confer any advantage in the natural environment. New research actually shows that when unintended by people, genetic modification of crops tends to do worse than ordinary crops. This indicates that the risks of superweeds may be smaller than otherwise thought. In other words, what this claim is saying is that random mutations tend to produce genotypes which are less adapted to the environment than the original organism. And so the vast majority of mutations are actually harmful. So why is it that we don't worry about random mutations in the genetics of crops or animals or so on? Because the vast majority of these mutations are not of any benefit. And so the organism simply dies off. Moreover, we need to realize that traditionally bred varieties equally can turn out allergenic or toxic. For example, perfectly natural peanuts can cause deadly allergic reactions in some people, and these are not even genetically modified peanuts. A new, conveniently bred, instant-resistant celery was loved by the organic movement. But it turned out that people who handled the celery developed rashes after subsequent exposure to sunlight due to the very high levels of the carcinogenic and mutagenic materials that were present in this celery. Likewise, a new conventional potato developed at the cost of millions of dollars had to be withdrawn from the market because it was acutely toxic to humans when grown under peculiar soil conditions. When the plant absorbed certain nutrients, the plant manufactured a toxin which normally it would not, which was highly dangerous to humans. This had not been foreseen in the original research, and so the result was withdrawing the plant from the market, as rightfully so. Many crops have been given pesticide resistance through conventional breeding techniques, not even approaching any form of genetic modification. Through conventional breeding techniques, and the spread of resistance to pests could equally well originate from these crops and not necessarily artificially genetically modified crops. Actually, most of our superweeds come not from advanced crops, but from alien plants. For example, the above-mentioned kudzu, or Japanese knotweed, is resistant to virtually every pesticide known to man. It achieved this on its own with no help from genetic modification of humans. The underlying theme is that problems stem not from a particular technique, GM or conventional, but from particular products. Rapeseed, whether it be GM or conventional, is by nature promiscuous and will attempt aggressively to infiltrate natural wildlife areas wherever it gets the opportunity. Thus, rapeseed with special features achieved through genetic modification or conventional breeding should arguably only be grown in areas such as Australia, Argentina, and Canada with huge open farmlands. On the other hand, wheat is almost completely self-pollinating and thus constitutes much less of a risk. This is why the British House of Lords, in their recommendation, said, "We need to look at the product, not the process." In other words, environmental groups have made people fear the word GM, genetic modification, regardless of the product that it produced, and had them love organic produce regardless of the conventional breeding that produced that plant. So this is irrational and should be corrected in the literature. Likewise, this is why the U.S. National Research Council, in their overview, stated that the potential hazards and risks associated with the organism produced by conventional and transgenic genetic modified methods fall into the same general categories. This also ties in nicely with the other typical concern of collusion and potential monopoly on GM foods stemming from ever fewer life science corporations like Monsanto. The concern is not that companies could patent existing varieties. Patent law, of course, requires innovation. Thus, farmers can easily go on sowing these varieties at their present cost. However, if biotech innovations are more productive, which makes them more profitable for the farmer, a near monopoly could reap almost the entire economic surplus from the improvement. Thus, of course, this of course argues for a strong antitrust regulations. But such issues are not related to GM technology, but to the basic regulation of the well-functioning market economy. Just as, for example, the case against Microsoft was not an argument against computers. Thus, the basic argument, both from biology and economics, is that the focus should be on making the best possible regulatory system. But we also need to realize that no system can provide absolute certainty. Science cannot prove that something is not dangerous. Let me repeat again. Science cannot prove that something is not dangerous. Technology cannot provide absolutely risk-free products. The products we have today are not risk-free, and neither will this be the case for the products of tomorrow. The difference is that we feel comfortable with the products of today, whereas we mainly see the products of tomorrow's products as potentially dangerous. Yet the promises of the new and improved products are also alluring. Which we choose depends on our awareness of the risk and our historical experience in overcoming past problems. Thus, choosing sensibly in the genetic modification debate requires us to see the risks, but also to compare them thoroughly with all other risks we are exposed to and make a relative comparison, a cost-benefit analysis. We need to know how we have handled past problems. We must be able to dispose of the many myths, but also face the true challenges faced with the proper information. It is only with this information that we can weigh the risks properly and also to examine objectively the benefits in order to make the most informed, scientifically based decision. In this way, the GM debate is truly only a replay of environmentalism versus the facts, and in a certain way, a replay of everything that I've presented in these programs. Most of the risks are very low, and many are unrelated or only vaguely related to GM technology. As a human species, we have not lived without creating problems, but overall, we have solved more problems than we have created, otherwise we wouldn't be alive today. And more importantly, problems that we have created have been addressed systematically. Yes, there are still a globe full of problems to be solved, but I am confident that human intellectual ability will systematically address these in the future, leading to better health, longer life expectancies, more general happiness on the globe. Some of the absolutely central arguments against GM, or genetic modification, are based mainly on myths. Yet there are definitely real problems to be handled, and that is where we have to focus our attention. Weighing the risks and the benefits, it seems obvious that the substantive benefits that genetically modified foods can deliver, both for the developed and the developing world, far outweigh the manageable risks, which, however, suggest the need for a strong regulatory system. My final words on this is that when you have a situation where there's such widespread ignorance among the public, and when you have completely irrational positions, such as, for example, the majority of Europeans, when interviewed, said that it was better for Africans to starve to death than to be eating genetically modified foods, then you realize you have a serious problem that needs to be addressed. And the problem is not with the genetically modified foods, but with the consciousness of many people around the globe who, while eating well themselves, are preventing other people with less than they have to have the ability to feed themselves. So in this six-part series that I've done since Earth Day back in April, I've tried to expose some of the issues which have come to the forefront since I organized the first Earth Day in 1980 to see how far have we come. I would like to state that in 1980, what drove me to invest the huge amount of time necessary to start the Canadian Earth Day Federation and to mobilize volunteers in Kingston, Ontario, was simply when I was driving to university one weekend, I happened to look at the sides of the highway, and I was disgusted with the number of empty pop cans, discarded beverage containers, the paper, general garbage that people were simply tossing out the window of their cars. That was the philosophy of the 1980s, to not care even whether you dumped your garbage out the window of your car. This was the paradigm. And so I really sincerely believe that not by talking, but by acting, I could change the paradigm. And so the first Earth Day consisted simply of me and a couple of volunteers getting donated garbage bags, which had been donated by DuPont, by the way, getting garbage bags and simply walking along the grass meridians of highways and picking up garbage. That was the essence of the first Earth Day. It is something that anybody could have done. No rocket science there, and simply leading by example, by seeing something that obviously had to be done and doing it. So, I mean, I'm no great hero. I didn't do anything that any of my listeners could not have done. All I wanted to do was change the mindset, change the paradigm, and clean up what I thought was a mess. And to that extent, I have been very successful, and that is encouraged by much stricter laws about littering, certainly, but also by a changed paradigm that people now, in general, keep their garbage in their vehicle, do not toss it out the window. They put it into bags in their cars and then dispose of it in proper containers when they get to a rest stop. This is a big improvement in the last 30, 40 years, and something that I am very proud of, that changing that mindset. Are we completely in the clear? No. There's still enormous amounts to do. For example, people still dump their old oil down into storm sewers, contaminating huge amounts of fresh water. There's still people who hunt animals out of season and catch more fish than they need to, than their legal daily catch. There's still people who waste energy. by idling their cars. So there's an enormous amount that still has to be done to continue improving mindsets, improving the paradigm of society. I think that we're about to see a major revolution as technology reaches a tipping point, as Ray Kurzweil said in his book, The Singularity. The advent of quantum dot technology, for example, has already been used to make super high-resolution TVs, which are now for sale at Best Buy. And it is going to be used to make very high-efficiency solar cells, which will convert at 80% efficiency instead of 16% efficiency like many of the solar cells that are available today. And this breakthrough will allow every homeowner to affordably convert their house into a power generating center. This power can be used not only to power their own house, to power, recharge their electric vehicle, but also can be funneled into the electrical grid and then used to power industry. The recharging of electric vehicles will allow a large amount of electrical power to be stored for the first time. As many of you know, electrical power, once it's generated, cannot be stored. It has to be consumed at the same time it's generated. But the advent of huge numbers of electric vehicles plugged into the grid will allow for the first time the storage of power using a peer-to-peer decentralized network. These are all really promising developments that I'm going to be addressing in future shows. And invite you to listen to my future talk addressing these issues in future shows. So thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you're listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenary. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
Critical Mass is a grassroots reclamation of public space that is held on the last Friday of the month, every month, in any weather. Enjoy the safety that we create by simply riding together. Bikes, skateboards, rollerblades, self-propelled couches, and any other form of human-powered locomotion is welcome. If you'd like to be part of Critical Mass, meet at Vancouver Art Gallery the last Friday of every month at 5 to 5:30 p.m. The cost is free. Bring the whole family! For more information, visit www.monkeyranchcafe.org or email autosaurus@tao.ca.
Can't you see I'm driving here?
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenary, professional futurist. You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Tenary, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
Ha hu agestig ri CJSF, nached poing aun FM, Crowley vo Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hello and welcome to this new edition of Viewpoints, where local news meets national audiences. On today's show, we'll be grasshopping across the country. In Ontario, some 200 students will have